This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, the very best bits of today's show, lovingly curated by Shruti Rajendran, who is back once again with the Renegade Master. It's 18th of May, Wednesday. Here's what's coming up. Federal Reserve overnight, more warnings from Jay Powell. A, rising interest rates. B, doesn't care if it's going to mean pain for the economy. You're just going to have to suck it up. Jay Powell's take in the US, Khatija Hack's take here in the United Arab Emirates from Emirates MED. Now, what else have we got? Goldman Sachs giving its senior staff unlimited leave. Sounds great. The reality, actually, is not quite so cushy. Charlotte Shedeville of the Chartered Institute of Personnel Development gives her thoughts. We've been talking Twitter. Mazen Nahawi of Karma, based here in the UAE, media expert, giving us his take on that. And finally, the Tinder swindler, Cécile Fleury, has been in a Netflix documentary, and she's been in Dubai speaking to Brandy Scott. That interview coming up. First up, though, let's dive straight into those rising interest rates. Starting with interest rates, because Jay Powell of the Fed was speaking overnight, the Wall Street Journal had an event, and Jay Powell was one of the speakers. And interest rates clearly front and centre at the moment. And he doubled down, as Brandy said, on this insistence that they are going to raise them to fight inflation, even if that means hurting economic growth. This is what Jay Powell had to say.
We have to get inflation down to 2%. We've got to restore, you know, our definition of price stability, and we will do that. I would say there could, as I mentioned, there could be some pain involved to restoring price stability. Growth has to move down. That's what has to happen for inflation to come down. You know, we raise interest rates, that affects financial conditions, and financial conditions affect the economy. So there are a couple of steps there, and it is not in any way a surgically precision set of tools.
Indeed not. Bit of a blunt instrument, raising interest rates to fight inflation. So what does it mean for us here in the UAE? He said there could be some pain for the US economy with raising interest rates. We're raising them here as well. Could that pain extend here?
Interest rates in the US have already gone up 75 basis points this year, and another 175 basis points in hikes is expected before the end of the year. This does mean higher borrowing costs for UAE businesses and consumers, and it's one of the reasons why we think non-oil sector growth in the UAE will probably be slower this year than it was in 2021. However, the UAE is also benefiting from higher oil prices, which may allow government to increase investment in the country this year. And we're also seeing foreign investment into the UAE as well, into the private sector. And this may help to offset any softening in consumer spending. So overall, we still think non-oil sector growth will remain fairly robust, probably in the region of around 4%. But it will be slower probably than 2021, given that we are facing these headwinds from higher borrowing costs.
That's Khatija Hack of Emirates MBD. So we asked her about interest rates, of course, and what it might mean for us here. We also asked her about all these IPOs, the latest cab off the rank, Borouge, the big petrochemicals firm, down the road in Ruwais, close to the Saudi border, big ADNOC subsidiary. $20 billion, says Bloomberg. Now, Khatija and her team are not buy-sell-hold analysts to tell you whether you should subscribe to the IPO or not, but there's so many of these privatizations that they do potentially spill over into the macro economy, into the bigger picture. So what does she make of them?
There are several benefits for IPOs for the broader economy, the two main ones being bringing in new private sector investment by selling shares, and also boosting the liquidity and the depth in local stock markets. If it is a state asset being IPO'd, then an additional benefit would be the release of equity from that asset, which could then be reinvested in other projects or used to pay down debt.
Khatija Hack of Emirates MBD.
Yeah, we're going to have to start speaking to the guys at the ADX, aren't we? I spent a good number of afternoons down on the DFM floor just figuring out the process of registering, seeing how many people were taking part. Speaking off the record to, you know, some of the staff who were helping people. And it was actually, dare I say it, quite a lovely environment that was created in there, you know, and quite a sense of buzz Does that mean I'm on the road down to Abu Dhabi? Your Abu Dhabi correspondent.
May well be so. Certainly there's good value in Borouge. They say there's going to be a $1.3 billion dividend next year. Now, if Bloomberg's right with their $20 billion valuation, that's a dividend yield of 6.5%. And that is decent. Even with interest rates rising, that's a decent dividend yield, so it might be worth looking at.
Yeah, they've got cheap feedstock, arguably. They're in the right place for it. They're making ethylene, which is used in an awful lot of things. So I'm going to do a bit of due diligence and see where we go.
Your challenge, Brandy Scott, should you choose to accept it, is not just to drive down to Abu Dhabi Island.
You want me at
the
factory, don't you?
Get yourself down to Ruwais.
You want me in a high-vis vest.
We do, on Microsoft Teams, with a hat on. That's the petrochemicals plant.
I'll get producer Mohammed on board. We'll see how we go.
Brandy Scott is brought to you by Polyoil Fins on the Business Breakfast, whatever they may be. They probably make you a high-vis jacket. Should we talk about working from home?
Yeah, shall we? I'm having a look at a piece of research that has come out from an organisation called Work From Home Research, funnily enough, and they do exactly what it says on the tin. They've been doing almost we're not post-pandemic, are we? The numbers out of the US and the rest, but they've been certainly doing a sort of second half pandemic survey, if you like, to see how people have settled into the work from home routine and the difference, the gap between employees and employers. Looking at around the world, different countries, not ours, disappointingly, as to how people feel about working from home, how many days a week they want to work from home and how many days a week their employers want them to work from home. Globally, people want to work about 1.7 days a week from home. So we'll call that 2 days, shall we? After COVID, by the way, was the question, not during COVID, but, you know, beyond this year, post-COVID, how many days would you like to work from home? We'll say roughly two. How many is your employer working for you to work from home? Less than one.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So there is a divergence there.
It is. The countries where people want the most work from home days, Brazil, the UK, Spain, Canada, the US and Singapore.
Tom, you've been looking at this as well, haven't you?
So it's just a little bit of accumulative evidence that I've been getting, sort of recurring themes here. And I'm wondering whether there's a bit of a generation game at play here. It's been reiterated again by this chat that we're having a little bit earlier on about senior staff, which would therefore suggest those that have been in roles a little longer and therefore those that are a little longer in the tooth, a bit more experienced, to give it the correct phrase. To sort of reflect on those that have just come into the workforce as well. So a bit of a generation, young versus old in the workforce. Reason I say this goes back to a story that came out last week. Sir Alan Sugar, who is not one for mincing words, you're fired.
He's the British billionaire who's the host of The Apprentice in the UK.
Yes.
He's Donald in the UK.
He's Donald in the UK. And, you know, he's cut from that old work hard, play hard, etc. He had a right old slanging match with PwC last week online, basically saying that they were, am I allowed to say this on air? Lazy so-and-sos. for putting in their hybrid working tweet. Basically, they tweeted saying, look, Friday's off now for PwC staff the world over. Friday afternoons, I should say. He said it was a blinking joke, to paraphrase as well, so that they were all lazy so-and-sos. They came back and said that he was childish and misunderstood and that he showed a total lack of awareness of the way that we work has evolved. Bums on seats does not equal productivity or a better workforce, in my opinion. Bit of a slang match between the biggest company in the world and somebody who's been there, done that. It's been sort of going on, though, isn't it? We had Bank of England, Andrew Bailey yesterday, governor, saying, don't ask for pay rises, just suck it up. Come on, let's get on with this.
If you're a high earner.
If you're a high earner. But he said it for all. He said, especially if you're a high earner, but for all. Jacob Rees-Mogg recently been called condescending as well for leaving post-it notes on civil servants' laptops saying, stop doing three-day weeks, you're only taking days off when it's sunny, etc. It's this whole thing is that you've got almost a bit of a generation game at play and a bit of a front line being drawn.
Interesting. I'm looking at who they've interviewed in the survey, and it's people between 20 and 59. So there is a span there. but I do hear what you're saying.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Good water cooler talker, this one. Over the last few days, investment bank Goldman Sachs has said that its senior staff will be allowed to take as much holiday as they want. No cap on paid leave under the bank's new flexible vacation plans designed to promote rest and recharge. Sign me up, people are saying. But let's get a little bit more on this one. Let's talk to the team from the CIPD, the Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development. Absolute pleasure to welcome into the studio the Acting Regional Director for the MENA region of the CIPD, Charlotte Chedivilu, joins us live in the studio. Charlotte, thank you so much indeed for being with us. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Tom.
Right. Is there, before we get onto the pros and cons, is there precedent for this or is this brand new?
Yeah, so first of all, I think it's pretty interesting to see Goldman Sachs adopt such a policy. It's a testament to how competitive the job market is getting, especially on Wall Street. And then we'll get into that, but I think it's really important to remember that this policy only applies to senior bankers at Goldman Sachs. When the bank has been criticized over the past couple of years for not treating junior employees in a correct way. And lastly, is unlimited leave really unlimited? Mm. That's the question. Now, yes, there is precedent. Netflix, very famous for its manifesto, was one of the first companies to apply unlimited leave. It was followed by IBM, LinkedIn, it's quite common in the startup world.
What are the pros of this approach?
Well, in theory, it sounds great. In theory, that would promote a greater work-life balance. It's aimed to empower employees. And it's great for the employee brand. I mean, who wouldn't want to sign up, like you just said, for an employer promoting unlimited time off?
There must be a few cons, though. What are the sort of drawbacks?
The main drawback is that all of this hinges upon culture. So what good would an unlimited time off policy be if you had a 24/7 working culture, like many companies are known to have on Wall Street? And then you need good line managers to support it. And we know that the great majority of line managers are not actually formally trained to lead their people. And finally, it can't apply to all roles. I mean, imagine you free hosting the show and taking unlimited time off. That wouldn't really work, would it?
Well, we could give it a go.
You're off in about an hour and a half, aren't you?
I want to address that sort of elephant in the room of come with regards, because you mentioned there, yeah, just for senior staff. I mean, you talk about culture for this having to work. Surely, I mean, is that something that junior staff aspire to, or does it leave a bad taste in the mouth?
Good question. I can't speak for them. It definitely raises a question of fairness, having a policy that only applies to senior staff. Especially then you'd wonder, why such a big PR announcement if it just applies to only a few employees? Is this just a PR gimmick when we know again how much criticism the firm had gotten? I think it's important to remember that culture is a consistent effort. It takes time to build a positive company culture, and they are quick wins as far as fixing an employee brand can be. So that's a caveat. Then I guess one of the things that we could see as a positive is that the toxic work culture is mainly perpetuated by the senior staff in Wall Street who are working 24/7, who are arguably workaholics. So then maybe them taking more time off would leave more freedom to junior employees.
Charlotte, I'm reading CNN's report of this over the past 48 hours or so, and they say often unlimited leave means you take less leave. This is what CNN reports. One study from 2018 found that employees with unlimited leave take an average of 13 days off per year, while those with traditional plans average 15 days annually. And CNN says some companies have found that workers, especially younger staff, end up taking fewer days off than they otherwise might out of a desire to prove their commitment.
Yeah.
Absolutely. What's the evidence to support that?
So much research like this report that CNN is quoting shows that companies with unlimited time off tend to have that effect. Now, why? Because unlimited means anything but unlimited, right? So it leaves employees with a lot of guesswork. How much is okay? So not only do we find that many employees will actually take less time off, but also very often they'll feel guilty doing so, not knowing where the boundaries are. So It has worked for some companies who have kept that policy. Like I believe IBM still has it, LinkedIn still have it, has it in some part of the world. But we are also seeing that a lot of companies that have tried that policy eventually took it back after a few years and would probably go for things like a more generous time off allowance, which is limited, but with more days. Some more innovative companies will offer a holiday allowance with, for example, $1,000 or $2,000 to spend on your holiday every year, which would be a nice perk. And this is not really mainstream at the moment, right? So I think in the region, realistically, we're expecting to see a four-day week or four-and-a-half-day weeks. That's been the talk of the town for a couple of years, or for a couple of months at least. And of course, flexibility and flexible working from anywhere, I think that's where we're seeing the future of work goes.
So fair to say that those companies that have tried to implement this policy, on the main, it's a policy that's failed so far.
Fair to say it is a policy that has failed so far. Now, it doesn't mean employees are not considering it. Our latest CIPD report showed that 7% of UK employers are already offering that kind of a perk or considering doing it, against 1% in 2018. So that's still something that's becoming more popular.
Just finally, just quick to go back to the point you were making there about, you know, the trends you're seeing here and what the data is telling you here. It's interesting because we have also heard a big sort of drive to get people back into the offices. But again, it's that drive but comes with a caveat in terms of there is that flexibility still.
Again, you always have what companies will want to promote as part of their employee brand and the practices that it will effectively do. In an ideal world, we'll see the two work hand in hand and actually be aligned. But we are seeing a little bit of a bipolarity in some employers, if you will. And so whilst we are promoting flexible work and flexibility from day one at the CIPD, that's something that we really believe has proven to work, but is also great for work-life balance, we are exactly seeing, especially in the region, employers pushing back for employees to be in the office. And don't forget, Goldman Sachs was one of the first ones to try and push employees to go back to the office just a few months ago.
Come back in, you lot, your little juniors. Meanwhile, seniors are all off on unlimited as well. Or not, as the case may be. Charlotte, really appreciate your time this morning. Thank you so much indeed for being with us and coming in and explaining it a little bit further. Charlotte Shedeville is the Acting Regional Director, MENA Region, for CIPD.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Here we are this morning, having a look at whether or not Elon has got cold feet. He said he might not go through with his $44 billion offer for Twitter if the company can't or won't prove how many fake accounts it has. The debate about whether or not Elon is genuinely concerned about bots and whether he's just having a little bit of buyer's remorse continues. But we wanted to dig into the bots themselves. We are joined by Mazen Nahwi, who is the founder and CEO of media intelligence agency Karma. And Mazen, it's good to speak to you. Good morning.
Good morning, Brandy. Hi.
When we talk about bots, Mazen, what technically are we speaking about?
We're talking about non-human algorithmic entities, which are basically pieces of code which masquerade as people or companies. And they are represented by handles on a social platform like Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, or Facebook. But they are not real human beings. And they can be manipulated to send out a huge amount of content on an algorithmic basis, which means someone who is trying to send out political messaging or corporate spam can send out a huge amount of content to a large audience without really being traceable or really having a proper human agenda.
How much of an issue do you think they are on Twitter? I mean, as a media intelligence agency, you're obviously speaking to clients, you're doing the sums.
They are a huge issue, and they have always been a huge issue. They falsify the metrics which social platforms are using to report. It means that when an advertising or a PR company is trying to report to their clientele on how much reach they've had, the numbers are usually quite inflated, and that's why everyone who is paying for social media advertising or engagement always struggles with this issue. No one really knows the truth. Nobody really knows how many human beings are on these platforms. So murky metrics, inflated impression and engagement data, and frankly, just a lot of social and political trouble all add up into a bad picture.
If you were to put a percentage on it in terms of campaigns and things that you see, what kind of percentage of interaction do you think is bot-driven?
It varies. I think if you're looking at a strong community talking about Premier League football, the number of bots involved are usually below 10%. If you're talking political, for example, Ukraine war, they could be up to 50%. They really vary by topic, but the rule of thumb is the more political it is, the higher the amount of bot involvement.
And how much of an issue are bots here? Do we see region-specific bots and at what kind of levels?
We do see bots, usually from a few neighboring countries. However, in countries like the UAE, for example, we have very strong regulations which impact social media usage. So many people are incentivized to be themselves and not to be bad.
What about non-bot bots? I mean, I guess I'm asking what counts as a fake user? Is it just those that are automated or those that might be being run by real people, real paid people who might be running multiple accounts?
There is a term called shadow engagement, where you have human beings masquerading as others, trying to bring their point of view or their client's point of view to the market or to a social media platform. So you are right, Brandy, they're not all automated. There can be human beings who pretend to be someone else.
So what could this mean for how much Twitter is worth as a platform? Elon has indicated that he's willing to negotiate the price. Twitter is kind of said he couldn't. And it all focuses around these monetized users. Twitter famously is criticized for not really making as much money as it maybe could or should. What does it all mean for the money?
It does mean that he's probably going to try and reprice the deal. I think he's talked about a minimum of 20% of Twitter's monetizable daily users as being bots. I think that's a bit of a stretch. At most, I don't think he'll be able to lob off more than 5 or 10% of the deal. I think any regulator or court would find that to be an extreme stretch. It's not like Elon just discovered there were bots on Twitter. He knew there were bots on Twitter going into the deal. And he has a responsibility based on the contract that he signed or the letter of intent that he signed to follow through with the best effort to conclude the deal. Trying to say that one element of an entire company should stop a deal, I don't think would be accepted by anyone. I think this is a ploy to reprice the deal and to probably improve payment terms and get more people like Prince Waleed to carry over their shares into a new arrangement so that the actual cash outlay and leveraged outlay that Elon will be putting forward will actually be minimized.
He's said that he's going to do some of his own research, a random sample of 100 followers for at Twitter, the Twitter account, ignoring the first 1,000, but effectively picking every 10th for 100 users and checking that they're real. I mean, you guys obviously do research, Mazen, for your clients. What do you make of this methodology?
It's clearly not a research or scientifically driven methodology. You need it to be based on your actual audience. So, for example, if 50% of your audience is in America and 10% in China and 5% in the Gulf, you need to start breaking it down according to that demographic. And then you break it down by income, age group, gender, just a random number like that simply is not scientific. It needs to be much more driven by a scientific sample. We actually do that all the time for our clients, frankly, on all social platforms. And we find that range of 5 to 50% that I talked about earlier.
People sometimes get quite nervous about the idea that they are the commodity as a user of one of these platforms. How much am I worth to you on Twitter? And am I worth more on a Twitter or on Instagram or even on Facebook?
Generally, the cost per 1,000, if you will, using basic paid terminology, is not that different between them. But I think you're worth to a company more if you're there at the right time and at the right conversation. So if you're an automotive brand trying to sell a car and most people aren't talking about cars, then their value to you and your value to them is probably nothing. But if all of a sudden they're interested in buying an electric vehicle, their value starts to grow over time. And I think one exciting development that a potential acquisition of Twitter may usher in would be pricing based on engagement, not pricing based on numbers. So that'll be an interesting one to watch.
Mezen Nahi, who's the founder and CEO of the media intelligence agency Karma, speaking to us this morning about Elon looking like he might be trying to reprice that $44 billion offer for Twitter. He wants more evidence about what percentage of users are bots.
Yeah, we've had messages in on this morning, someone suggesting that this is Elon, pure negotiating tactic. This is how Elon works. The market value of Twitter as of last night was $29 billion. He's bid $44 billion. Is there an argument this isn't really about bots? This is just about the big sell-off in tech over the past 6 weeks.
Yeah, look, there's a lot of analysts who are saying that he's either trying to reprice the deal or pull out of it completely.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Where we are going to hear now from a woman who has become famous for all the wrong reasons. Cecilia Fialhoy is the woman who was defrauded by a man she thought was her boyfriend, lending him money that she herself had borrowed. But he wasn't who she thought he was, and she wasn't alone in being scammed. It was a story worthy of a movie, all private jets and fake passports, and it has become the hit Netflix documentary Tinder Swindler. Tinder Swindler. Keep wanting to say Tinder because of the title. Tinder Swindler, the platform's most watched documentary of all time. I sat with Cecilia yesterday on the sidelines of the top CEO conference where she was speaking to talk to her about what has happened since the documentary and about the foundation, Action Reaction, that she has set up to help victims of fraud. For those who haven't seen the documentary, I asked Cecilia to give us the bare bones of her story.
I was defrauded back in 2018 by a man and with a team, and he said he was the son of a diamond mogul, and he defrauded me for over $200,000 in a very sophisticated scheme.
As we mentioned there, her story has become one of the backbones of the most watched Netflix documentary of all times. I asked her what the documentary has meant for her.
It's meant everything. It's been meant by taking seriously, hopefully getting some justice in it all in the end, and actually warning people about that there are this type of scams out there.
Yeah, because no one's actually been charged because of Cecile's story, or indeed the other woman who joined her yesterday on stage here in Dubai. I asked Cecilia how seriously she was taken when she first started to tell her story.
I was not taken seriously at all when I was defrauded. You went to the police and the interview was done in an hour, and the banks were like, pay us now because you need to start paying.
Yeah, $200,000. Now, Cecilia, to update us about what position she's now in financially.
To say the least, when you lost that much money, you don't know where to start. You don't know how to pay it down. You don't know which creditor. So I was taken to court by four banks. And in the end, I had to make myself bankrupt because I lost those court cases. My creditors in Norway didn't want to say yes to that bankruptcy. So I'm still in very high debt.
Have her creditors become more sympathetic since the documentary?
No, they're not more sympathetic. In reality, if they got their way, I needed to do a very strict 5-year payment plan with them on top of what I've already given them. And I just feel like, you know, when you feel that you're trying to help professionals and you're trying to help businesses understand fraud, and you feel almost because you've been speaking up, they're punishing you for it. Because it's been 4 years already of my life, and to have 5 years on top of that, that's 10 years of payment plans. And I felt, as a fraud victim, you don't deserve.
So I said to her, what does she think needs to change?
I think more people just speaking up as we are, and that people are not ashamed anymore to say, oh, I clicked that link, or I did that, or I saw an email and I didn't realize that it was fake. That we can say that without feeling ashamed, that, yeah, we get all defrauded in different aspects. This is just one, which is very mentally difficult for us because you have emotions and you are in love, which is really difficult to endure, but everyone gets tricked. So I think more people speaking up and having more laws in all the countries to protect people, and that the police are actually not dropping cases as quickly, because I think that gives a message to the criminals that this is a safe crime to actually commit.
Well, Cecilia is helping others, basically. She set up a foundation, Action Reaction, to help other victims of fraud, and she told me about that.
It's been set up to be a resource center for fraud victims and other groups of people that are maybe relatives, you know, that how they can support them, and banks and financial institutions, law enforcement on how to do interviews. I really want it to be like a one-stop hub. I'm starting now with the mental health aspect and the peer support, because I feel that's a very specific thing that no one is covering at this point. And of course, being a spokesperson, talk to politician, always being a lobbyist. You know, the banks have lobbyists, and I'm thinking, okay, you need to be on the side of the fraud victim and then talk to politicians on how to create laws that can protect us a bit better.
Now, the mental health thing is really big, and Cecilia's very open about the fact that she briefly ended up in a psychiatric ward after realising what had happened to her.
You become mentally so low, and why I ended up being so low was that it was the reaction both from people I knew and from the rest of society that told me that we are not taking you seriously and we're not going to help you. So combining with the fraud, that's when you get to the point that you are hopeless, because no one is telling you things are going to get better. In the end, you have to tell yourself, or you have the support I had in my family, luckily. So, and I got some peace, quiet, got to sleep. I hadn't slept for several weeks, you know. So I think help people. When you get defrauded, support them. Even though you felt that they were stupid, that doesn't mean that what happened to them was fair or right.
Cecilia's foundation is also going to educate people on how to report fraud and navigate the system. I asked her about the current laws around fraud, what she felt needed to change.
I don't know internationally about the laws, but I know in Norway when I went to court, I was trying to use a law that says that if you're under pressure and threats, when you were taking up loans, you're not supposed to be able to pay them back. But I didn't win with that because it's like a sleeping law. It's a very old ways of threats they were looking at. For example, you go out in the street and someone comes up and say, I have a gun, take out £200 and then go to your ATM and take it out. That's the kind of threats. Mine was more like psychological threats. So in the way, the banks won because there are no laws that I could actually use to in these type of fraud cases, which are very intricate, I understand. But I think we should look over them and think it is new digital age, and especially with international fraud as well. We're not in just one country anymore. People are traveling. We need closer collaboration with the police in different countries.
So what kind of outpouring has she seen? How many people have reached out to her through the foundation, and what is she hearing from them?
I have to say it's heartbreaking to hear the stories. These are people who have lost everything. In maybe the poorest countries, I get from Honduras, you know, Colombia, get from Brazil. It's all over the world people are writing to me, and they're wondering what I can do. I've lost hope. I trusted this person. It's heartbreaking stories, and I can't help everyone individually, and that's my biggest heartbreak. That's why I hope that this foundation can grow. But it has been an outpouring to, and what people are saying the most, the money is one thing, but I felt actually I can't trust anyone again.
So where is Cecilia now, physically and emotionally, as she tries to repair her own life?
The fraud in itself, I'm not traumatized by it anymore because I talked so much about it. When you go to two trials and you have to be questioned by, can you imagine? You have to really reflect over what you did and why you did it. But I have to say, I'm still traumatized by how I've been treated by the banks to have to go to two trials. It's the most traumatic thing I've ever done. I had my mom and dad there as support, but poor them, you know. It's not fun for them either to see their daughter. So where I am now, I'm doing better, but I'm still, as I said, I'm still struggling with my debt and hoping to find a solution soon. But we are doing these type of talks. We are trying to spread the word, and like, we have a lot of projects, and we're still, yeah, it's still justice. We still haven't gotten justice. So I'm just going to work hard until I get it.
That's Cecilia Fialhoy, one of the wildly impressive women who features in the Netflix documentary Tinder Swindler. She was speaking yesterday at the top CEO conference here in Dubai.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.